Today is Thursday, February 23rd, 2012. This recording is of Eric Aho and is being made at his home in Saxons River, Vermont.
For the past 20 years or so, I've been engaged in looking at the world that I live in, the world that I live in here locally. Among other places, I've traveled far and wide and I've painted far and wide, but that has really been most engaging to me has been this conversation, if you will, visual conversation back and forth across this Connecticut River Valley. One of the formative paintings of the Hudson River School has Thomas Cole's View of the Oxbow, which is there's a version at Smith College and there's a version at the Metropolitan Museum. It's the Connecticut River just south of here in Northampton, Massachusetts, seen from Mount Tom. Thomas Cole is one of the reasons that we paint the landscape as we do. There's a direct family tree going through from Thomas Cole to Frederick Church on through and emerging somewhere out in Fairfield Porter in the 1950s. In the 60s, and then continuing on. My perch over the world isn't from Mount Tom looking over a 19th century Connecticut River. It's a perch high above Walpole, New Hampshire. I discovered this field. It's in private hands, and I asked permission to set up a regular presence up there with my easel. And my perch up over Walpole gave me sort of commanding views to the south and to the west and to the north of the Connecticut River. That is where I learned how to compress atmospheres. I wanted these landscapes to be more than topographical views. I wanted them to be, connected to the human being, to me. I wanted them to be autobiographical. I thought to a rather naively, I guess, I thought that just by sitting in New Hampshire, my childhood home, looking over into Vermont, my adult home, that narrative would imbue the painting with enough autobiographical momentum to be interesting, right? To be full and to be interesting. And certainly when nearly all the paintings that I make refer to some other painting, it's just it's just something that is deeply engaging to me, whether they're, 19th century landscape paintings like I was just talking about, or Poussin, or Claude Lorrain, or Corot. An endless stream of ideas and influences come across the paintings. These big open views of this landscape, I would sometimes joke, were kind of like Willem de Kooning and Frederick Church on a picnic. And you just imagine the conversation that was happening over coffee or a whiskey were these paintings. For a while that worked. For a while I really believed that. Then I started to question that. I started to question my conviction in that direction. Was that really the case? The paintings were changing. I was responding to different things. And I suppose those responses were insisting that I asked myself different questions. As I've discovered, the painting, you can't push it very hard. It has to push you. You have to respond to it. It's not a willful experience. The will actually has to be suppressed because the painting's will is, I think, a bit mightier. I look at the landscape, I look at the color intentionally, and then I put it down in a rather incidental way, and I see what happens. I see where it falls in relation to the other marks, where it falls in relation to the space I'm trying to establish. And certainly with the views over the Connecticut River, what I'm looking at in the world and what I'm looking at on the canvas, I'm trying to create, a seamless arrangement of spaces. Space in the painting is as real as the space out there in front of me, unfolding in front of me. That's a matter of conviction and belief and learning to manipulate the material, guide it into place somehow. So the questions that I realized that I needed to ask myself weren't so much about the paintings weren't about asking myself about how to show this place and how to depict this place that I was painting, but it was more about what was this place doing to me. And I realized that as the paintings were changing, becoming a little bit looser, more broadly brushed, even more abstract, although that's a term that I find very difficult to use sometimes, the color became very specific. The temperatures of the color became very specific. But I was getting further away from the tenements of realism. I had always held to this idea that you paint what you see. But that stopped working after a while because, I mean, it gets into the larger question of, you know, what is it we're seeing and how is it that we're seeing? But I realized that up on that hill, it was the fuller sensation of that space that was really engaging to me. And I hadn't asked that question of myself yet. I mean, I was rather tyrannized by the view. I mean, here's a beautiful view. I mean, it's a classic representation of the landscape, of any landscape. It's like out of a Poussin painting. It's the Piedmont Hills from Italy in a Renaissance painting. It's a classical representation of the landscape without overt depiction of struggle and the trail, the map of getting to where one's going. It's just kind of, it just unfolds in front of you like a blanket. I found one of the challenges was depicting that and making it not a pretty picture, but make it something that was really engaging in a visual, sensual, painterly way, right? But, after many years of this, I mean, this process takes a long time. And after many years of this, I realized questions I needed to ask myself were, what does this place feel like, rather than what does it look like? I was struck by the changes in temperature. I was struck by the wind in my face. And it was, you know, the last groups of paintings from that hill, I wasn't even looking at the landscape. I was looking at the painting. But I was looking at the painting and taking in everything that was around me in a full sensory way, I think. You know, I'm not sure that they, as paintings, they're very successful. But what I think I got to successfully was what it is I was finally after. I had to make a decision. As much as I said that the paintings will tell you where to go, can't be too willful about them, I had to make a willful decision and choose to step away from that hillside. And I thought, you know, what better place to go than deep into the landscape? So I found an abandoned quarry in Proctor, Vermont that I commuted to for close to 3 years. And I worked essentially in a big cut in the rock in the middle of a mountain. So I looked at the structure of that mountain, and I looked at the very confusing distances, because you can't quite tell how far across the quarry pond the rock walls are. You can't really tell how high they are. There's nothing to measure them against. And I liked that kind of uncertainty in that place. And I was looking at new forms and new atmospheres that were kind of microclimates inside that quarry. The first paintings of that quarry show the landscape at the very top with a pocket of sky. And then the very last ones, I had erased the need to have that grounding point, that mooring. I kind of erased that from the paintings, and they were just paintings of the rock face, as austere and as minimal as anything I'd ever done. But they were so real to me and so full that to this day when I look at them, I can see the big pocket of light there, even though the painting itself is just a painting. It's a flat slab. It's about 60 inches wide, but I can see this big pocket of light. Very interesting, compelling transference of experience there. I traveled extensively throughout the Finnish wilderness and Finnish countryside, and deep into Lapland, and then further up into the Norwegian Arctic. And these remote places taught me to look at different landscapes, to look for commonalities between places, and to look at how sort of human events and stories are held in these landscapes. I recall once sitting in a field at the edge of the White Sea in what is now Western Russia. It was at one time part of the Finnish province of Karelia, which was ceded to Russia in a treaty after the war. And I was sitting in this field painting these enormous thistles that were 4, 5, 6 feet high, thick as an arm, beautiful black-violet colors with that dusty bloom on them, and the flowers, like incredibly fragrant flowers. I was painting in this field, and a man on a bicycle approached me, and he said to me in perfect American English, he said, "You know that, you know the story of this field." And I said, "Well, I said that I didn't. I'm just kind of passing through," and that I found it striking and beautiful, and I wanted to make a painting of it. And he said that this is allegedly one of the sites of Stalin's purges, that there's an entire village of people buried underneath, not far under this topsoil, and only the thistles have grown here since. And then he just hopped on his bike and kept going. So he dropped this story on me, which not only transformed my idea of the place, I mean, it physically transformed my painting. I mean, because I couldn't return to what I was doing with the same lightness. I was aware of something very different. From that point on, I have listened very closely to what passersby have to say about the places in which they live. I was struck by that field, the black violet of the thistle against the, you know, the kind of straw brush yellow of the grasses. Beautiful on any level, but there's a tragic beauty, if you will, of how those two stories, the visual and the recently sort of intercepted story, kind of coexist now. Anyhow, that's an image that I've been thinking of returning paint, partly because the way that I'm working now allows for more room to explore that than the mere depiction of these the thistle, or the thistle pressed against a darkening sky or something like that. In a similar way, a few years ago, I was in my backyard painting the shed behind the house. I've always been struck by how in the late spring and in the summer, the light on the full front of that shed is so bright. It essentially cuts out the rest of the shed. It reduces that building to just that archetypal form of the house. And the door open, there's a big black pocket in there, which has always reminded me of the ice holes that I've been painting. And I suppose all of the white buildings that I look for are surrogates for the lack of ice in the summertime. And one of the compelling things about the ice is the reflective quality of it. So I'm into my third or fourth painting over several weeks of this garden shed, and an elderly woman walks up the driveway, interrupts me, and excuses herself, and sorry to bother you. And she said, "Oh, I see you're painting the old ice house." And I thought, my goodness, here it is again. You know, someone's casual remark, she has no idea how this has just transformed my entire world. Certainly the world of this painting, it took on a further austerity and a further starkness, and the darks got darker and the whites got whiter, and it just became more intense with that knowledge. The ice cut paintings, you know, in some ways they're not even my experiences. They start from my father's stories. He would tell rather traditional Finnish stories from the Finnish oral tradition, stories from the Kalevala, the Finnish epic, which is the story that all the Finns know but have never really read. But he would also tell in elaborate detail stories of his own childhood, which I think he knew somehow was very special. He was born in 1920, so by the time he was 8 or 9 years old, he was working in the winters on an ice harvesting operation, both in Townsend and in Brookline, Massachusetts, and in Ipswich, New Hampshire, this community of Finns. It was a rather elaborate and large-scale ice harvesting operation right on a train line that from Boston. So the ice cars, the refrigerated, insulated cars, would pull right up to the ramp, and the blocks of ice would be dragged by horse up to a conveyor belt, and they'd be loaded, packed in sawdust and loaded right on. It was all done right on the spot, part of quite a large business venture for the local community. As far as I understand it, it was run by a cooperative of Finnish farmers and business people, that it went to Boston and that it went off to all parts of the world. Imagine that ice from New Hampshire and Massachusetts, he'd say, going all over the world. It was the details that stuck in his mind and then lodged into mine, details such as, well, certainly the Finns talking or not talking, but of course they do. And but they talk over coffee and they talk over sauna, and it was the smell of the coffee, which always has a little bit of dried fish in it. Apparently coffee likes to have a little salt in it to kind of cut the bitterness, and the Finns have always put some fish bones in big pots of coffee. The smell of the wet wool, the animals, the diesel equipment that they were using. He started doing this in 1928, so by the end of the Depression, by 1938, there was diesel equipment. There was a whole other mechanized element to this ice harvesting that happened during this time. And these details loomed so large for him. I mean, obviously, it's some intensely personal, formative experience for him that he told to us repeatedly through our childhoods. And then again, this is the story that he shared with me on his deathbed, hours before he died. I mean, I always welcomed hearing them, but it was one of those, oh, not again, Dad. You know, we've already heard that. I think we all have a relative or an uncle or someone who insists on telling that same story again and again and again. And it's told for a reason. It's told because they need you to remember that piece of their life. They need you to remember it so clearly and to know it as if it's your own so that they continue on. And it became, I mean, of all the experiences that a person goes through, my father certainly had many. He chose that one. Or it shows itself, in conversation just before he died. And that just further cemented the vitality of those images in my mind that many years later, I have built my own sauna on a friend's pond in New Hampshire that we attend weekly with the family. And throughout the winter, I cut a hole in the ice. I have acquired over the years all of the old ice harvesting tools. In fact, all of the tools that my father would have used, I have acquired just as talisman, really, just to kind of further conjure this idea and have some connection with that past that I didn't have in my own experience. And he never said, oh, you know, you don't realize how lucky you are. So in front of the sauna that I built, I cut a hole in the ice. And part of the Finnish sauna culture is that you go from the bath and then you go into the extreme of this plunge pool. It's called the Avanto. The water's some 34 or 5 degrees. It's a shock to the body. And then when you step out, you feel like you won, like you have beaten nature. You know, it's the middle of winter, and it may be 22 degrees and blowing wind, but you don't feel it, because your body has just braced itself. And for a moment, you know, you can sit on the porch of the building and just be quiet. And I tend to just look. I look out, and the building has the view of the Connecticut River Valley, and it off to one side. But then right in front of me is this square in the ice, which I've looked at for 10, 12 years. And then I started thinking about my father's story of ice harvesting. And I realized how it right there in front of me was everything that he's talked about. In some ways, the image that's sort of most deeply personal to me, but it hadn't occurred to me to make a painting of it until I saw it in a different way. I saw it in relation to a larger story rather than the literalness of what it was. And as soon as I saw that, you know, I took the image in my mind back to the studio and I drew it out, and I found it to be amazing. The accuracy to which I could remember the colors in the reflected shadows in the ice and the packs of snow on top of the ice and the blackness of that water. Blackness is, and there isn't a black in the palette. I mean, it's a chromatic black. It's many different colors mixed together, but it's both as deep as the imagination is willing to go, and it's also as flat as the black paint on the surface of the canvas. So it becomes immediately very complex. And someone wrote that it's very complex genealogy, which I agree with. You know, it starts with these stories of the ice harvesting and its references to old Finnish culture and immigrant culture. And then it relates to larger Finnish culture in general and the culture of the sauna. Then there's the actuality of the whole, of just the frankness of the whole, which you put your body into. And even if you didn't know that it stood in opposition to the fire that's inside the sauna, the human instinct is to put your body into that hole or to stay out of it. When you're viewing these ice cut paintings, those are the questions that'll cross your mind. Are you going in or are you staying out? But you're drawn to it, which is kind of curious surprise that I found. As these paintings unfolded, they're also about, because they have to be for me, they're about painting. And so they're about the origins of abstraction in painting. They're about Courbet in his great painting, The Burial at Ornans, where he puts the grave right in the very front of the painting, so much so that the viewer famously is in that grave looking back at the mourners. There's that relationship. Then there's some ways very direct relationship to abstract painters like Ellsworth Kelly, Kashmir Malevich, the Russian painter from 1915, his Black Square. And then, you know, even contemporary painters like James Turrell, who works with light and the landscape in, you know, in magnificent ways. In many ways, the painting that's my most simplest is the one that's fullest of everything that I've wanted a painting to be, both deeply personal, broadly universal, and forever threaded to the art history that matters to me. So those paintings are unfolding now over a 10-year period. I'll make one a year over four paintings into it, so I have a few more to go. And the titles refer to the years of the Great Depression, so it's essentially a period from 29 to 1938 or so. And they are sort of a subset of the larger ice paintings that I do. A little bit more conceptual somehow, because the ideas are kind of there. I remake the painting every year, like I remake the whole regularly, and then I look at it anew. So you can actually see the changes in temperature and climate and atmosphere in each of the paintings. Over the years, when I've been traveling, had been traveling to Ireland to paint these big skies, I'd spent 8 or 9 summers in Western Ireland watching the theater of weather come off the Atlantic Ocean and hit the hillside. I mean, the skies and those weather conditions are so low and tangible. You can see them forming. You can really learn how to anticipate the trajectory of the weather. And I learned how to apply that to my own atmospheres and the weather patterns here, although the skies tend to be much higher. But from my perch over the river, I could see all of that unfolding. During those trips to Ireland, I'd stop into the National Gallery in Ireland, and I would visit this one painting in particular, a little Rembrandt painting called The Rest on the Flight into Egypt. It's about 14 by 16 or 18 inches. It's the only nocturne landscape that Rembrandt made. While it has the biblical scene, the family on their trip, it's rather incidental to the overall composition. And what struck me about this painting, and what continues to amaze me about other paintings, is how I respond to them. We can't predict, we can't begin to know how we're going to respond to a painting. We know that X and Such is a famous painting, and we look at it dutifully, and we admire it. We admire it more for what we know about it than for what we felt about it. But this little painting, as incidental as it is in many ways, struck me in a significant way, kind of on that level where I made it myself. Everything that it was representing were concerned to me. There's a black ravine running through the center of the painting, and above it there's a silver moon breaking over that ridge, and then in the foreground there's a warm interior campfire. So there's a warm light contrasted with a cold light separated by this ravine. And I suppose, you know, in many ways, it reminded me of farmers' brush fires here in Vermont. But I hadn't put those pieces together. I kept that painting in mind. And then couple of years later, I was intending to run some errands. It was a March afternoon. It must have been 4:30 or so. I needed to get to the post office and the bank and to do these things before they closed. And I was driving out of town. The sun is setting. The moon is rising. And one of our local farmers is burning his brush. And the ravine has already gone black. And I stopped right then and there. I had little canvases and my painting materials in the car. And I set up and I painted. It was the Rembrandt painting. I saw it right in front of me. And, you know, there's this great Cézanne-ism where he says you carry around the idea in your head until you see it in nature. In a way, you know, I've been cogitating on this idea for so long, and then it just presents itself to me. And it seemed to me like a gift. And I spent the whole afternoon there into the evening painting these brush fires. There were several of them scattered around the field, and the moon breaking through the clouds. And if it wasn't exactly the same thing that Rembrandt was imagining, it had all of the qualities of that. But it was mine. And that kind of possession, you know, the idea and the experience is something that's... It's hard won, and it doesn't happen often or on that scale. And it led to a series of paintings that I worked on then for another 6 or 7 years. These fire paintings, where they went from these contained brush fires to, well, I just imagined them stepping out of control a little bit. I had never seen a forest fire, and of course, as the series of paintings developed, they became more frequently in the news. A friend who was traveling in California had sent pictures of the wildfires in Santa Barbara. I've never used photographs, and I just did not want to be influenced by the photograph. But I opened up my email one day, and there was this photograph of an over-the-top modernist Hollywood home. It was perfectly manicured world with in the foreground, this kidney-shaped pool illuminated, glowing turquoise green with the raging fire behind it. I learned that by law, when you abandon your house, you have to leave your pool lit so that at night the firefighters can come in with their helicopters and take water from the pool to douse the fire. So that's one reason that it was lit, I think. But for me, what I saw was the arrangement of shapes and ideas in the photograph. And then I saw this sort of isolation of sort of a human element against the natural element. And I repurposed that. I reconstructed it for my own, you know, painting idea. And that's where the pool paintings came from. They were kind of, you know, I joked with some friends that they were kind of the anti-David Hockney paintings, where his paintings are about casual pleasure in California life. These were about sort of denial of pleasure and the abandonment of pleasure even. So it occurred to me at some point that the exchange that I've been engaged in between making these fire paintings throughout the summer and into the fall, and then as winter arrives, I put them away and I start the winter painting. The paintings are always generated by changes in the season. You can see that as the progression of paintings go through the year. But it occurred to me that this exchange between the fire and the ice is really of that fundamental exchange between extremes, and the extremes of the Finnish sauna, the fire, that sort of life-giving fire, and then the ice, which is that sort of life-extracting, life-taking element, or life-arresting element somehow. I mean, that's sort of the backstory of them. In the end, they're really about the extremes of the imagination, the extremes of what I personally, emotionally, artistically, intellectually am capable of doing, you know, my own limits, and the extremes to which I'm willing to push myself. I would hope that they relate to the larger sense of what we as individuals are willing to do in order to experience something, to understand something, you know, how far we are willing to push ourselves, and to remind us that we live in a world of extremes, that our lives are built on that tension. We need it, in fact, I think. And that painting is fundamentally, for me, about constantly wrestling with those extremes, be it dark and light, warm and cold, big, small, you know, relationships of scale, large and diminutive, or thick and thin, viscous and sticky, surface contrasts, material contrasts, color contrasts, contrasts within contrasts, subsets of tones within tones, things like that. Even the minutest of contrasts seem to be significant at a certain point. The fire and ice paintings demonstrate and remind us of that contrast, remind me of that contrast. And they're about further elements, the extremes of the imagination. And the fire has been the classical representation of the imagination. And ice is, there's something untouched about it, something pure to my imagination. I mean, I paint a frozen surface because it reminds me that there are things in the world that are momentarily pristine and that are also fragile. You know, as thick and as rugged as the ice appears to be, when it fractures, that in the larger scale of things, that it's tremendously fragile. And in further contrast, it reminds me of the fragility of human skin, which gets to my sort of overall desire to have these landscapes, that they're not seen as something separate from, the human experience, but that they're big enough to be, that they are the human experience, that they're not seen and witnessed from a distance so much as they are felt anew at the moment each time. I mean, I guess that's my goal for them. Certainly when dealing with the extremes, like, the fire and the ice, the viewer gets that. There's something inhospitable about each. But then, curiously, there's something intimate about them, each of them as well. The ice, for those reasons that I just explained, and then the fire, too, for the delicateness of those extreme temperatures, those reds and oranges, which relate to the sun and relate to life and our own pulse, really.